Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the new head of the Diocese of Gary. An Indiana judge handed religious conservative groups a loss in their lawsuit challenging the so-called fix to the state's controversial Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Purdue University Northwest Director of School of Engineering, Dietmar Rumpfer. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A Michigan Monsignor has been tapped by Pope Francis to head the Diocese of Gary. Monsignor Robert J. McClurey, 56, is a priest of the Archdiocese of Detroit and currently serves as rector of the National Shrine of the Little Flower Basilica in Royal Oak, Michigan. McClurey will replace Bishop Donald J. Hine, who was appointed in 2015 as the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary. Hine was recently named the fifth bishop of Madison, Wisconsin, and was installed in that role June 25th. The Post-Tribune reports McClurey was ordained as a priest for the Archdiocese of Detroit, his hometown, on May 22, 1999. His new appointment was publicized Tuesday in Washington, D.C. by Archbishop Christophe Pierre, Apostolic Nuncio to the U.S.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana woman has pleaded guilty to providing financial support to the Islamic State group. 33-year-old Samantha El Hassani entered her plea Monday in a deal in which federal prosecutors agreed to drop more serious conspiracy charges against her and to request a more lenient sentence. The Times reports that she hasn't been sentenced yet. The plea agreement states in late 2014, her late Moroccan husband and his brother traveled to Syria and joined the Islamic State. She made three trips from the U.S. to Hong Kong between November 2014 and April 2015, carrying more than $30,000 in cash and gold intended for the Islamic State. Intended for the Islamic State group. El Hassani's husband was killed in Syria.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities have taken three teenage boys into custody after a missing Indiana woman's body was found in an abandoned elementary school in Gary. Adriana Saucedo of Portage was found dead more than 1 week ago after she was reported missing. Portage police say the 27-year-old allegedly met with a Gary teen to buy a small amount of marijuana and was picked up from her home in a, quote, prearranged purchase. Three teens allegedly robbed and fatally shot her in the car and dumped her body at the old school. Portage Police Chief Troy Williams says dozens of officers have been working on the investigation, which is still ongoing. Saucedo is being remembered as a caring person. Her nephew, Isaiah Mangrum, says she was the best aunt he could ever have.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
At a public hearing Monday, dozens of students and teachers voiced their support for three Indianapolis schools to become charter schools after they exit state takeover status next year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports the school's former district wants to stop the process.
The group called Rethink Forward Indiana is acting on instructions from the State Board of Education to apply for charters for three schools formerly part of the Indianapolis Public Schools District, Emma Donna Middle School, Thomas Carr Howell, and Emmerich Manuel High Schools. During the hearing, some cried as they supported the schools. Alice Glover, the Manuel alumni president, she was one of 50 people to speak in favor of the charter applications.
And I don't trust IPS to keep Manuel open. They could shut it in a heartbeat. Thank you.
No one spoke in opposition, but in written comments, The Indianapolis Public Schools District say they do not support the group seeking the charters. The vote to approve the applications is December 13th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than half of Hoosiers get their health insurance from their employer, and that coverage is growing more expensive. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on a new analysis that examines this trend.
The report from the Commonwealth Fund looks at all states and finds Indiana is in line with the nationwide increase in costs. From 2008 to 2018, the annual Hoosier employee contribution rose from 3.8% of a person's income to 5.7%. Sarah Collins, a VP with the Commonwealth Fund, led the study.
Even though premium costs take up a large share of people's incomes, many people are not getting insurance that offers them good cost protection. This is because, for many, deductibles are also high.
Add in an average $1,800 deductible for employees, and people in Indiana pay 10% of their median income out of pocket. Collins says research shows that high deductibles may discourage people with modest incomes from getting needed services. The report is part of the group's ongoing study into factors that drive high health care costs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana judge handed religious conservative groups a loss in their lawsuit challenging the so-called fix to the state's controversial Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The RFRA fix said the 2015 law's religious freedom defense couldn't be used to justify denying service to someone based on characteristics such as age, race, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Religious conservative groups argued in court last month they want to discriminate against the LGBT community. And that's why they said the fix and local anti-discrimination ordinances infringed on their religious beliefs, thus violating the Constitution. But the state and four cities, Bloomington, Carmel, Columbus, and Indianapolis, said there's no evidence the groups actually discriminate against anyone. And a Hamilton County judge seems to agree. He ruled against the religious groups.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A sea of teachers and public education supporters swarmed the State House this month. They were there to put pressure on lawmakers and demand better pay, school funding, and more respect for their field. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports advocacy efforts focused on public school issues have been boiling over this year, making the stakes even higher in 2020.
It's a Tuesday morning just before 7 o'clock. It's still dark outside, and I'm getting on a school bus with a group of more than 20 teachers from Bedford, just south of Bloomington. We're going to the State House. Anna Wall is sitting toward the front of the bus in a thick red hat. She's an elementary school special education teacher, and she's talking with some of the other teachers about different shades of red they have on and what today means for them.
This isn't something I go to. I don't go to state rallies. I mean, I'd rather be in the classroom.
Wall says she doesn't follow policy really, but she's seen changes in the classroom. And she's joining some 15,000 fellow educators as they call on lawmakers for things like better pay and equitable funding for schools. They also want fewer tests to evaluate kids, schools, and teachers.
And I think I want to say that yes, I do stand for something. I stand for a teacher. I stand for all my colleagues that we are working hard.
Fast forward to later that morning. The sun is up and a wave of red-clad public school educators and supporters fill the State House and the lawns outside, carrying signs and chanting different messages of frustration, hope, and power. They even have a marching band blasting music fitting for a pep rally. It's the same day lawmakers return for the ceremonial start to the legislative session. The rallies echo through the building and outside for most of the day, reflecting a national movement called Red for Ed. Many say contentious policy changes and underfunding of public schools over the past decade led us here. And as State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick speaks to a crowd of reporters outside of her office, a few dozen teachers already inside the State House gather to listen.
We are not asking for the moon, nor are the teachers who are here. We are here asking for the basic foundations that makes an education system great and in turn makes a state great.
One of those foundations is funding. House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning met with a group of teachers earlier in the day. He says right now, money matters are a tough ask.
This is not a budget year, so historically we have not opened the state budget.
He says lawmakers are ready to listen as they rework school measures of accountability and consider a second look at a new and controversial licensing requirement they approved last session. Many educators say they feel disrespected and unheard by lawmakers in the State House, too. Boehning says he thinks more, clearer communication could help ease that tension.
I will say that there's a lot of blame that we need to be accepting as well, that we need to be more open to having dialogue. And I'm not opposed to talking to teachers about where I am, where they are, and let's see if we can come together.
Teachers are already coming together in a way. Superintendent McCormick has encouraged educators to wield their voting power and has been increasingly vocal about their concerns heading into her final year as the state's chief of schools.
Our students deserve every bit of this advocacy that you see, but it is a shame that it takes this type of advocacy to get what our students deserve.
Educators hope to carry that kind of energy into the 2020 elections. It's hard to say how different legislative races could play out with a freshly fired up base of teachers, but next year's race for governor is a big one. The winner will choose McCormick's successor, appointing the state's chief of schools for the first time. And teachers like special educator Anna Wall hope someone will champion their needs in the State House.
I want respect. I want, you know, all the years of education that I do and all the training that I do on my own naturally, that it counts for something.
And to get it, the crowd made it clear. They're ready to take their frustrations to the ballot box next November. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Purdue University Northwest's Dietmar Rumpfer.
Purdue University Northwest School of Engineering is expanding, and it's also deepening its connections with industry and with manufacturing partners here in Northwest Indiana in some rather new and novel ways. And one of them is involving faculty internships. And with us to talk about it, we have the director of the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest, Professor Dietmar Rumpfer, with us. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us a little about this idea of a faculty internship. Is this a well-worn idea out in business and industry, or is this something new, or maybe it's really new for academia?
No, this is really a new and innovative idea in academia, certainly. Doing some research on this a couple of weeks back, I found out that Boeing had a somewhat similar program that they called their Willever Fellowship. That ended about 2005 or so, but in academia, this is a novel idea. And I'm happy to say we have received fairly enthusiastic support for this idea, both in colleagues from academia. Others are interested in that as well. And my external advisory board was really very supportive.
What was the process of being able to take this idea that's worked very well in business, you mentioned with Boeing, and be able to extend it into Purdue University Northwest?
This is a program that was developed at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. Ultimately, it went back to ideas that I had that I discussed with my external advisory board. I have a number of industry representatives in this external advisory board from local and regional industries. We have a lot of support from NIPSCO, NiSource. We have the steel industry. ArcelorMittal is involved there. And so together with those representatives, I brought up this idea at one of the external advisory board meetings, and we developed it from there.
Mm-hmm. Will you be able to create a faculty internship? Give us an idea which faculty members are most likely to be interested in becoming interns in this way, and also to what they may certainly be involved in if they pick a business or an industry out there, as I know that you're starting to have now with your very first intern out there.
So this is a program for all faculty in the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. And maybe going a little bit back to the background that this is built upon. Mm-hmm. One of the core ideas behind what we're doing with the School of Engineering, and going even further back, the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest is a very new school. It was founded in the summer of 2017. I was hired as the founding director of the School of Engineering. We had two engineering departments before. We have a Department of Mechanical and Civil Engineering and a Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. But then university leadership decided that we wanted to raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest as a Purdue institution. Clearly, engineering should be one of the signature programs at the university. And so then the question is, how do we go about doing this? How do we raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest and, frankly, in Northwest Indiana? And one of the things that are important to me personally as well is that a university and a school of engineering, they need to be embedded in the fabric of the region that is hosting them. So we want to build two-way relationships between the university, in my case, and of course, with the School of Engineering and the surrounding community of industry, innovators, communities, startup entrepreneurs, and all of these people. So the question is, how do we create these deeper connections? And so this faculty internship is one way to do this. Mm-hmm. The idea is that, on the one hand, we allow our stakeholders, entrepreneurs, people in industry, communities, to take advantage of the expertise that our faculty have. So if they have projects that they would like to have some help on, then we can make faculty expertise available to them. So this way we can help our surrounding community with the expertise that our faculty have. And on the other hand, our faculty have the opportunity to learn about new approaches, to learn about the current problems that industry is dealing with, and then to bring this knowledge back to the classroom so that they can train our students better, so that they stay up to date, and ultimately our students will be able to hit the ground running when they go back to industry.
Do you think that this is an opportunity that I know Purdue University, all of the campuses are very strong on, is experiential learning? Yeah. To be able to get the student really ready for life outside of the ivy walls, so to speak, and being ready to go out there in that profession that they would like to take on with their degree.
Yes, exactly. So experiential learning in all engineering schools across the nation, that is something that has become very important. If we go back in history a little bit, if you look at the way engineering schools were run in the 1950s, it turned out that actually the majority of faculty were people coming out of industry. They were practitioners. So the education of engineering graduates was very practically oriented. But then people realized that in order to have graduates that are ready for unknown challenges, for new technologies that are coming up, remember we were starting to think about going to the moon, there was this idea that our engineering graduates should be stronger on fundamentals. And this was the start of what was called the beginning of engineering science and the engineering scientist. And as a consequence, engineering departments became much more focused on hiring faculty that were scientists, that did research, and the education of engineers, certainly in four-year programs and beyond, became much more theoretical, which had all sorts of benefits. This was a good thing. So, as you know, we went to the moon and we developed all these new technologies. But there was a downside as well in that the education became less practical, and industry started to notice that they needed to spend a significant amount of effort to take these graduates coming from engineering schools and make them ready to work and be productive for their enterprises. And so obviously time scales are relatively long. Things move slowly in academia sometimes. What happened then was there was more and more an emphasis on practical education. There is a central accrediting agency for engineering education, ABET, which then required all students to have what we call a capstone design experience. So this meant that practice-based learning and experiential learning became more important in engineering education. So fast forward to where we are now, all engineering schools that are accredited by ABET, meaning all engineering schools basically, have practice-based learning as part of their curriculum. So with this faculty internship, we're expanding the range of these things to not only have practice-based learning for our students, if you will, but also have practice-based learning and keep our faculty up to date with practice in industry.
Professor Renfer, if there are any faculty members with the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest that are interested in getting involved in this internship program, how do they go about getting signed up to at least apply for it?
Yeah, so there is a process that faculty need to follow. They write a little proposal that describes the goals of this faculty internship. They are required to have some industry contacts, so they need to propose a specific partner or host, if you will, in industry, or could be a community partner. We had cases where people wanted to work with research labs. One of our faculty was interested in working with the University of Chicago Hospitals for a project. Mm-hmm. So faculty write this proposal, and we evaluate the proposals and then award a certain number of these fellowships, of these scholarships to our faculty.
I understand one of the professors, Tom Liu, is involved in this program. Now tell us about Professor Liu and what his internship is all about this time around.
Yeah, Dr. Liu was the first of our faculty to take advantage of this opportunity. He is someone working in fluid dynamics. He has actually done some fascinating work on fluid dynamics of flying insects and you know, biological problems in fluid mechanics, but he's also an expert in experimental fluid mechanics, doing laser-based flow diagnostics, what we call particle image velocimetry methods, which allows you to do experiments where you can measure the full three-dimensional velocity field. So you get very detailed information of the flow field for flows around all sorts of devices. In this particular case, he had methods that allowed to measure flows in ducts and pipes, and that was his connection to Dwyer Industries, which is a regional company. They're headquartered here in Michigan City. And he was working with them to improve flow measurement systems that they use, and ultimately they benefit all sorts of flow systems in pipes with liquids, HVAC systems, so heating and air conditioning systems. Ultimately, this helps make these kinds of devices more energy efficient.
How does he think of the internship program he's in so far? Is he going to feel like he's going to be able to take something out of it and bring back to campus?
Yeah, so both partners in this particular collaboration are very happy with the result. Dr. Liu is bringing things back to the classroom. Dwyer Industries is also happy. They got some concrete developments out of that, some improvements of their systems.
You think maybe that some place down the road that Dwyer Industries may have an opportunity for an actual student intern, someone who's going through the process of learning and will pick up some actual experiential learning, as we've talked talked about?
The wire industry actually does host student interns from the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest already, and we're continuing this program. We're actually, for many of the companies that we work with, I'm happy to say that we are ramping up our activities and our connections. There's all sorts of touch points between the School of Engineering and industry beyond these faculty internships, which are brand new. Historically, we always had interns. Our students were working in local industry on projects. Our capstone design experience for our engineering students is also somewhat special. In that this is a two-semester program. Mm-hmm. Many engineering schools have just one semester of senior design projects. Our senior design projects are two-semester projects, which means they can be more expansive, and they usually result in concrete outcomes. And oftentimes there's advances that these students make that are directly of use in industry.
Professor Diepmer-Remfer, it sounds like that this is a great opportunity for not only for faculty members at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest, but also for the seniors who are beginning their degrees from Purdue Northwest to pick up some of this as well, too. And let's hope that the internship program grows as it does over the years. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Diepmer-Remfer is the director of the School of Engineering at Purdue University Northwest at the Hammond and the Westville campuses.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.